Ladies and gentlemen, we present at this time the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan. After you listen to the address by Father Coughlin, you're invited to write your comments to WHBI, Newark, New Jersey.
Ladies and gentlemen, Father Coughlin will address you today on the subject, not anti-Semitism, but anti-communism. Hundreds of thousands of persons have requested copies of his last two addresses. During the past week, criticism of these addresses have occupied much space in the press. These will be answered today. Hundreds of thousands of persons in this audience will be anxious to have a copy of the address about to be delivered in order to read it carefully and analytically. Copies of these can be had by writing directly to Father Coughlin at Royal Oak, Michigan. Before Father Coughlin comes to the microphone, the Shrine of the Little Flower Choristers, by transcription and conducted by Emil Cote at New York, with Mr. Cyril Guttrell before me at the console of the organ, will sing Schubert's Ave Maria. Approximately 4.5 minutes will be occupied with this singing. During these 4.5 minutes, each one of you has time to telephone at least one friend or family to listen in to this most important and courageous address. Please go to the telephone and invite some friend to join you in this audience. Schubert's Ave Maria.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Father Charles E. Coughlin from the Shrine of the Little Flower at Royal Oak, Michigan, in his address, Not Anti-Semitism, but Anti-Communism. Copies of this address can be had if you will write a letter to Father Coughlin at Royal Oak this week. Father Coughlin.
Good afternoon, my friends. 2 weeks ago, the minds of our American citizens were focused upon the latest outburst of Nazi persecution directed against the Jews of Germany. Every newspaper heralded abroad the news of a $400 million fine imposed upon 600,000 German Jews by a government which already had restricted the liberties of Catholic and Protestant and Jew. A government which, thanks be to God, has not resorted officially to the guillotine, the machine gun, or the kerosene-drenched pit. This was the first time our apathetic generation was aroused to the cries of distress which were sounding upon heedless ears since 1917. This magnificent publicity was regarded as a rainbow of hope which filtered through the dark clouds of despair. Recognizing it as such, I seized the opportunity to raise my voice not only in condemnation of this latest manifestation of persecution, but to amalgamate the forces of a sympathetic world against all persecution, be it that of Catholic or Protestant, Jew or Gentile. Surely, thought I, these barbaric outbursts against race or creed must be traceable to some common origin. Surely a chastened world must be willing to sacrifice its selfish, racial, and nationalistic objectives to militate against the common cause of all the afflictions experienced by all our fellow men resident abroad. Without attempting to minimize the atrocities of Nazism, I drew to the attention of this audience the excesses of communism. I insisted that Nazism was only a defense mechanism against communism. To an intelligent audience composed of intelligent Christians and intelligent Jews, I appeal. Let us distill our sympathies not only from the tears of the oppressed Jews, but also from the lifeblood of 20 million Christians. That was my prayer. Let us attack communism and destroy it from the face of the earth. If we are scientific in our approach to the whole problem of persecution, for causes must be removed before effects can be destroyed. That was my counsel. For having made this appeal, for having suggested this counsel, for having pointed out that atheistic Jews were too prominent in furthering the cause of Lenin and Trotsky with its religion of atheism, its patriotism of internationalism, and its security of confiscation, I was most unexpectedly assailed by those who characterized my address as a defense of Nazism and as an expression of anti-Semitism. Of these misunderstandings I tried to dispose last Sunday when I produced the previous Sunday's broadcast by transcription. Unfortunately, those who seemingly reject both my pleas and my counsels, and whose official, organized silence towards communism manifests a most alarming situation, unfortunately, they have not seen fit to meet my challenge of distilling their sympathy both from the tears of Jews and the blood of Christians. Instead, they have intentionally dodged the issue by endeavoring to confuse the public mind, particularly through the use of managed editorials and mismanaged interviews. For emphasis, let me repeat that the controlled press has failed to face the issue which I presented. Would not a dispassionate judge be inclined then to conclude that the effort on the part of my critics to assail my person and scoff at my presentation of facts would he not conclude that this is related to their desire to protect communism? My friends, there would be no warrant for my continuing to occupy your attention with further argumentation on this subject. Had the press inaugurated an honest effort to arouse sympathy against the atrocities of communism as well as against the injustices of Nazis. But the press has failed. Therefore, in loyalty to my fellow Christians, I in turn am challenged to pursue my course. Permit me first to restate the underlying principle which is associated with persecution. To remove all persecution from the world, persecution both of Jew and of Christian, it is necessary for us to consolidate the fair-minded support of all fair-minded citizens, Jew and Gentile. To organize successfully public opinion against not only Nazism, which no sensible American Christian can logically support, but also against communism, which no religious Jew can honestly sustain, we must have as our objective social justice for all. Social justice whose principles are founded upon the teachings of Jesus Christ. Since then, there is a weapon which my adversaries choose. I am constrained to continue my battle. I must lift up the shield of defense against false assertions. I must use the sword of factual truth to oppose them, lest my silence be interpreted as surrender, and lest such a surrender be regarded as a victory for the anti-Nazis over those whose battle cry is anti-Nazi and anti-communist and anti-injustice with Christ over all. Therefore, this afternoon, I will pursue my case by considering the arguments presented by my critics last week to sustain their untenable position of silence regarding Christian persecution. My opponents' arguments are classified, first, in the editorials of certain newspapers, second, in the arguments of Alexander Kerensky and Leon Trotsky, third, in the publicized statements made by Kuhn Loeb Company. Fourth, in the statement attributed to the Office of the American Secret Service. As to the newspapers and their adverse editorials of the past week, do you recollect the complaint which I uttered two Sundays ago? On that occasion, I expressed the thought that when millions of Christians in Russia, Mexico, and Spain were made targets of the machine gun, little or no publicity was given by the public press to these persecutions, which future generations will regard as the worst atrocities of all time. Then there was a silent press. Then there was a venal press that eulogized those responsible for establishing a policy of recognizing Russia. Then there was a calloused press that belittled the grief of Spain and Mexico. Although many newspapers have not taken a position of hands off the communist question and hands off those who silence support it, yet a powerful group of papers practically have adopted that attitude. They gloss over our recognition of Russia. They applaud when congratulations are cabled to the haters of Christ. They vacillate between the Spanish loyalists and rebels. They praise the liberalism of Mexico. And why? You ask me why? Or do men gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistles? Or can the fig tree, my brethren, bear grapes or the vine figs? It is not in a spirit of retaliation that I remind you of these things. For you know that the editorial content of many papers is colored by the logic of the advertising dollar. The advertising dollar which manages editorials. Nor is it in the spirit of revenge that I use the following concrete example to prove the viciousness of an inspired press whose editorials and news articles manifest a serious lack of responsibility and honesty. but in a spirit of truth and of courage to defend truth, I dare to unfold for you the following concrete story of a typical controlled newspaper. A story where those or their representatives who control the advertising dollar control the freedom of the press. Last week, Rabbi Leo M. Franklin of Temple Bethel, Detroit, Michigan, sought an interview with Mr. Henry Ford to discuss with him, among other things, the possibility of the Ford organizations engaging the services of certain refugee Jews whom the rabbi expected to be expelled from Germany. In the presence of Mr. Ford and his executives, this matter was discussed at some length. A resume of Mr. Ford's conversation was written by the rabbi. Confessedly, it was the rabbi's composition, not Mr. Ford's. It was the rabbi's concept of not what Mr. Ford actually said, but what Rabbi Franklin would prefer he had said. Following this meeting, the Detroit Free Press printed a purported first-person interview with Mr. Henry Ford. It was captioned by front-page headlines which read, quotations, "Ford assails Nazis, persecutions, and welcomes Jewish refugees as valuable addition to U.S. life." In a statement severely critical of the Nazi persecution of the Jews, continues the Free Press, Henry Ford Wednesday night declared that he favored the admission of persecuted Jews to this country under the selective quota system, unquote. The purported interview, quoting Mr. Ford and carried in all the newspapers at home and abroad, this purported interview, quoting Mr. Ford in the first person singular throughout, was not given by Mr. Ford. The interview which the Detroit Free Press said was given out at Dearborn, Michigan on Wednesday of last week was not given out by Mr. Ford or by any of his executives on Wednesday night or at any other time. Here, my friends, was a gigantic attempt to put into the mouth of America's foremost manufacturer words that he did not say. To my mind, a new low in editorial responsibility, a mark seldom equaled in the history of American journalism, was attained. Social Justice Magazine, distrustful of the purported interview carried in the Detroit Free Press of December 1st relative to Nazi persecution, sent its investigators to ascertain the facts of the case. Mr. Harry Bennett, speaking officially for the Ford Motor Corporation and in the presence of Mr. Henry Ford, the same Harry Bennett who arranged the meeting between Rabbi Franklin and Mr. Ford, permits Social Justice Magazine to say the following in a signed statement. Quotation. One, the direct quotation carried in the paper is totally inaccurate and was not written by Mr. Ford but was composed by Rabbi Franklin. Two, Rabbi Franklin came to see Mr. Ford to ask him if his factory would assimilate Jewish refugees, the result of Nazi persecution. Mr. Ford said that he believed there was little or no persecution in Germany. If any, it was due not to the German government, but to the warmongers, the international bankers. Moreover, while Mr. Ford expressed his humanitarianism for all people, yet he believed that Jews wouldn't be content to work in factories. That was the essence of the talk between Mr. Ford and Rabbi Franklin. But the story handed to the Free Press was written by Rabbi Franklin and handed to it by Rabbi Franklin and not by Mr. Ford, unquote the signed statement. Ladies and gentlemen, the above quotation from an article which will appear in Social Justice Magazine on this travesty in journalism is authentic. There, then, is a sample of inspired news of a controlled newspaper dispensing for public reading as if it were a direct statement composed by Mr. Ford himself. For what purpose, I ask? Possibly for the same purpose and subject to the same influences. When some newspapers find it profitable to adopt a policy of silence on Christian persecution abroad, they are willing to headline the $400 million fine levied against 600,000 Jews day after day. Oh, by their fruits, these news journals shall be known. However, after the deluge of last week's editorial tidal wave, whose origin we now know, I was expected to feel pretty much as Mark Twain did. Mark Twain, who related in his memoirs his experience, which he had as an editor in Virginia City, Nevada. As well as I recollect, the humorist said, "Seated in my editor's chair one day, I was confronted by the gargantuan figure of a man I had abused in an editorial a few days before. He glowered at me. I knew I was in for it. But as always, my native resourcefulness pulled me through. As the giant advanced on me, I stood up. He charged. Cleverly, I contrived to get his arm around my waist and his elbow under my chin. We wrestled about for a moment, and I succeeded in keeping my feet high in the air. We fell to the floor. Again, my resourcefulness asserted itself. For by a deft movement, I got his knee in my stomach and his fingers tight about my throat. Then I had him. My friends, next permit me to analyze and refute the statements publicized by Mr. Kerensky and Mr. Trotsky. Alexander Kerensky, one of the chief witnesses whose testimony is supposed to stultify my plea to oppose communism together with Nazism, a witness whose contribution was intended to confuse the public mind, is not well known to the younger generation. Mr. Kerensky was prominent for a period of 7 months in 1917. He was the leader of the first of three Russian revolutions. Most men of our generation believe that he had gone to the happy hunting ground of lost causes. Presupposing that the American public had forgotten the three Russian revolutions since 1917, presupposing that the public mind entertains the error that there was only one Russian revolution since that date, Mr. Kerensky arises from the tomb of the past to remind us that he fathered the revolution, which for shortness of life and insignificance of effect will be classified with the frequent uprisings which come and go with every sunset in Central America. As a matter of record, Mr. Kerensky's revolution came in like a lion in the windy month of March 1917 and left the stage of this troubled world like a lamb in October of that same year. Contrary to common opinion, Mr. Kerensky did not successfully annihilate Tsarism. On the contrary, it was the guns and bayonets of the Trotskyites and Leninites that accomplished that in July 1918. They of the Second Revolution, who succeeded in overthrowing the Kerensky government. The First Revolution was devoid of atheistic Jewish domination, and for that reason, possibly, was a failure. It lasted only 7 months. But the Second Russian Revolution, which, for the sake of clarity, we now refer to as the Trotsky Russian Revolution, this one not only drove Alexander Kerensky as a wanderer over the face of the earth, not only murdered the Tsar and his family in 1918, but inaugurated the mass murder of 20,400,000 Christians. That was the real Russian Revolution with its dictator, its subjugation of 160 million people, its pogroms against Christians, its professed atheism, and its advertised internationalism. Mr. Kerensky, the father of the first assault against the injustices of Tsarism, practically vanished from the headlines in 1917. But on this, the occasion of his reappearance, I welcome the opportunity to agree with him heartily that the Jews had only an insignificant part in his failure. I agree with him that after he fled Russia ignominiously with the coming of the Lenins and Trotskys in October 1917, I agree with him wholeheartedly that the Jews, who were successful in establishing communism over the stillborn corpse of his socialistic effort, that these were apostate Jews, as he calls them, or atheistic Jews, as I term them. On one important point, I do not agree with the testimony given by this revolutionary, a testimony which was accredited extensive space in all the important news journals of America. This witness said, according to the Detroit News, November 30th, quote, The suggestion is ridiculous that the Jews financed the revolution, unquote. He should have qualified his statement by saying, my revolution. He continues by stating that, quotations, the revolutionary government obtained credits not through any bankers, Jewish or Gentile, in America, but from the United States government, unquote. I say that according to reputable testimony, it was financed by Jacob Schiff. Remembering that we are discussing the first Russian revolution, which flourished only from the spring until the autumn of 1917, let me be of assistance to the failing memory of this witness by quoting the New York Times of March 24, 1917, a photostatic copy of which I have before me. On that date, this newspaper said, quotations, the movement, referring to the Kerensky Revolution, the movement was financed by a New York banker you all know and love, quoting Mr. Kennan and referring to Mr. Jacob Schiff. Following this statement, made by one of the then leading foreign correspondents, Mr. Kennan, the New York Times informs us that a Mr. Parsons arose on the platform of Carnegie Hall and said, quotations, I will now read a message from White Sulphur Springs sent by the gentleman to whom Mr. Kennan referred, unquote. A portion of the message reads as follows, quotations, will you say for me to those present at tonight's meeting how deeply I regret my inability to celebrate with the friends of Russian freedom the actual reward of what we have hoped and striven for these long years. Signed, Jacob H. Schiff. To confirm my contention that Mr. Jacob Schiff contributed to the activities of the Kerensky Revolution, let me quote the Jewish Communal Register of New York City, 1917-18, edited and published by the Kahila, the Jewish community, of New York City. On page 1019, it states, quotations, Mr. Schiff has always used his wealth and his influence in the best interests of his people. He financed the enemies of autocratic Russia and used his financial influence to keep Russia from the money market of the United States, unquote. Surely these are reputable sources of information which I present to refute Mr. Kerensky, who said, quotation, the revolutionary government obtained credits not through any bankers, Jewish or Gentile, in America, but from the United States government, unquote. I am not mistaken in my previous contentions, unless Mr. Jacob Schiff assumes to be identical with the American government. Ladies and gentlemen, the Alexander Kerensky abortive revolution was a failure. Possibly, I repeat, because it was not managed by the revolutionary atheistic Jews, although it was financed by Mr. Jacob Schiff, the senior partner of the Cohen, Loeb and Company. Let us now turn our attention momentarily to the second Russian Revolution, which began in the autumn of 1917. Mr. Leon Trotsky was one of its prime movers. He was a successful revolutionary. Now an exile in neighboring Mexico, this witness was persuaded to enter the lists against me last week. A revolutionary who, after the death of Lenin and the advent of Stalin, was in turn forced to become a wanderer over the face of the earth. I believe that history will support me when I state that Leon Trotsky has come to court with most unclean hands. He is the crystallization of Nero, Diocletian, Julian the Apostate, Ivan the Terrible, Cromwell, and Napoleon Bonaparte, the outstanding mass murderer of time and eternity. This Leon Trotsky, whose correct name is Bronstein, this most unfortunate of all possible witnesses whom my opponents could persuade to testify against me, said last week, quotations, the name of Jacob Schiff means nothing to me. If Mr. Coughlin indicated an important sum, then it must be pure invention, unquote. I should not dignify such, shall I say, such an unreliable witness as is this Bronstein with a rebuttal, lest the ghosts of his 20 million victims should rise from their resting places to assail me. Ladies and gentlemen, permit me to discuss the widely read statement issued last week by the banking firm of Kuhn Northern Company, disavowing its connection with Russian revolutions in general and Mr. Jacob Schiff's financial association with them in particular. This statement appeared specifically in an early edition of the New York Times on Tuesday, November 29, and was withdrawn from the later editions of that paper on that same day. The statement, in part, reads as follows. Kuhn Loeb & Company, in a statement last night, said, "The firm of Kuhn Loeb & Company has never had any financial relations or other relations with any government in Russia, whether Tsarist, Kerensky, or communist," unquote. An additional paragraph of the same statement informs us that the late Jacob Schiff, quotation, had no relations with any fomenters of the Bolshevik uprising, which destroyed the Kerensky government, being utterly out of sympathy with their methods and principles, unquote. Ladies and gentlemen, the documents to which I referred in speaking of Mr. Alexander Kerensky are pertinent to this last contention upheld by the Kuhn Loeb & Company last Tuesday, for Mr. Jacob Schiff was the senior partner of that firm. When considering the Kuhn Loeb & Company, we are considering a unit of that generic abstraction so often referred to as international bankers. In every nation throughout the world, the various units of this fraternity operate, shuttling gold back and forth to balance exchanges, issuing credits from nation to nation, not only for productive commercial enterprises, but also for destructive and military ends. From the sunset which marked the passing of the glories that characterized the 13th century, down through the welter of wars which besmirched the pages of each succeeding age, the shadow of the international banker hovered over every battlefield, cast gloom over every home, and fastened the burden of death upon every innocent babe. Theirs is a fraternity which owes allegiance to no flag. Theirs is a patriotism which transcends the boundaries of every nation. For them, empires and kingdoms, principalities and republics are chessboards. With their shuttling of gold and credit, scepters form, crowns roll in the dust, and millions of pawns victimized by purchased propaganda are claimed by death. Mammon is their god, the god of greedy gold. Internationalism is their religion, the religion of fettered slavery. The Kuhn Loeb statement opens the avenues of thought which lead to such considerations. For the present members of this firm are anxious to deny any relationship to any revolution. First, they should prove to a suspecting world that they have no relationship to the international bankers resident abroad. Kuhn Loeb & Company is an international banking firm. As such, then I will refer to it when now considering the statement it issued, as well as on future occasions, if there be further need. Once more, then, I hereby refer to the British White Paper, which contains documentary evidence received from the Secret Service. The existence of this White Paper and of the reports incorporated therein cannot be brushed aside by idle denial. Last week, I telephoned to Dr. Dennis Fahey at Black Rock Seminary, Dublin, Ireland, asking him to reinspect an original British White Paper from which I quoted. He assures me that an original copy is still available, safely guarded, and at my disposal. And he assures me that it contains not only the references which I made to it last week, but also the excerpts from which I am about to read now in connection with the assertions issued by Kuhn Loeb & Company to the effect that neither the firm of Kuhn Loeb & Company nor any of its partners, past or present, assisted in any way to finance the communist revolution in Russia or anywhere else. Section 8 of this British White Paper reads as follows. Quotations. "If we bear in mind the fact that the Jewish banking house of Kuhn Loeb & Company is in touch with the Westphalian Rhineland Syndicate, German Jewish house, and with a Brothers Lazar Jewish house in Paris, and also with the Jewish house of Günzburg of Petrograd, Tokyo and Paris, if in addition we remark that all the above-mentioned Jewish houses are in close correspondence with the Jewish house of Spire and Company of London, New York, and Frankfurt on the Main, as well as with the Nya Banken Judeo-Bolshevik establishment at Stockholm, it will be manifest that the Bolshevik movement is, in a certain measure, the expression of a general Jewish movement, and that certain Jewish banking houses are interested in the organization of this movement. Unquote white paper. Now permit me to elaborate on this statement, which I supported with quotations from the British white paper, which was reinspected just last week for reassurance. Let me elaborate by referring to another collection of documents known as the CSON Report. This latter collection of documents, whose authenticity is guaranteed by the National Board for Historical Service of the United States, and is accepted by the United States Congress, is official. Document number 57 of the CSON report is a circular issued on November 2nd, 1914. Among other things, it says, quotations, Zinoviev and Lunacharsky got in touch with Imperial Bank of Germany through the bankers Rubinstein, Max Warburg, and Parvis. Zinoviev addressed himself to Rubinstein and Lunacharsky to Altwater, to Warburg, through whom he found support in Parvis, unquote. Here, then, the international bankers, among them a Warburg of the same family of Warburgs associated with the Kuhn Lohr Bank, is one of the internationalists aiding and abetting revolution. Document 64 of this same official government report is a letter written by J. Furstenberg to Raphael Scholand on September 21, 1917. And it says, quotations, Dear comrade, the office of the banking house, M. Warburg, has opened in accordance with telegram from president of Rhenish-Westphalian Syndicate an account for the undertaking of Comrade Trotsky. Signed, J. Furstenberg. Of course, the world knows the relationship existing between M. Warburg and the banking house of Kuhn Loeb & Company. The banking house which last week is reported to have said also that the late Jacob Schiff, its senior partner one day, had no relations with any fomenters of the Bolshevik uprising which destroyed the Kerensky government. The document from which I just quoted definitely relates to Trotsky's revolution against Kerensky. And it definitely indicates the activities of international bankers in fomenting communism, bankers who have intimate financial relations with the firm of Kuhn Lohr and Company. In quoting the CSON report, which deals with the German Bolshevik conspiracy, we read in the introduction, quotations, that the Committee on Public Information publishes herewith a series of communications between the Bolsheviks themselves and the Germans and the Bolsheviks. The documents show that the present heads of the Bolshevik government, 1918, Lenin and Trotsky and their associates, are German agents. The quotation continues to say that they show that the Bolshevik revolution was arranged for by the German Great General Staff, financed by the German Imperial Bank and other German financial institutions, unquote. However, it is perplexing to find that these so-called German bankers who dominated the government and its officials were oftentimes Jewish international bankers. Germany was their residence, but the world was their home. Now, supplementing all these documents which I have quoted, documents which I've used in helping to refute the charge of Mr. Kerensky, and the statement issued by the Kuhn Loeb Banking Company of last week to the effect, in the Kerensky instance, that his revolution was financed not through any bankers, Jewish or Gentile, in America, and in the Kuhn Loeb instance, that the firm of Kuhn Loeb and Company had no financial relations or any other relations with any government in Russia, may I produce the startling evidence of another governmental document as a refutation. It is a document published by the United States Department of State in a now rare volume entitled papers relating to the foreign relations of the United States, 1917, Supplement 2, The World War, Volume 1, page 25, file number 763-72119-5638. It reads as follows. The Secretary of State to the Ambassador in Russia, Mr. Francis. Washington, April 16, 1917, 1321. Please deliver following telegram. I'm only quoting the last two sentences. We are confident Russian Jewry are ready for the greatest sacrifices in support of the present democratic government as the only hope for the future of Russia and all its people. American Jewry holds itself ready to cooperate with their Russian brethren in this great movement. Marshall, Morgenthau, Schiff, Strauss, Rosenwald. Addressee, Milyukov, Petrograd, or Baron Gunzburg. If sent to Baron Gunzburg ad, may we ask you to submit this to your government. Signed, Lansing. My friends, comment upon this startling document is almost unnecessary. Two names of the Kuen Loeb firm, Schiff and Strauss, are mentioned in this telegram by the Secretary of the United States, Secretary of State, Robert Lansing. But of more importance, of astounding interest, my friends, you learn from this communication that Woodrow Wilson, Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, was in this instance, and in his official capacity, the Secretary of the Jewish International Bankers in helping to plot revolution with its subsequent mass murder and practice atheism. May I pause to repeat what the whole world knows? That these German financial institutions referred to in the CSUN report were dominated by international-minded Jews. Warmongers, who more than any other classification of citizens in all the world were responsible for the Holocaust of 1914-1918. One could add that they not only dominated the imperial government of Germany, but it appears they had tremendous influence in our own government. Page after page of the Overman report, in which the CSUN report is incorporated as a government document, displays this incontrovertible fact. Alas, my friends, history will not only attribute the financing of the Bolshevik Revolution to this type of internationalists, history will become more eloquent day by day in proclaiming to posterity the part they played in manipulating the press and propaganda, in controlling public opinion, in bestirring racial and national animosities, and in unleashing the four horsemen of the apocalypse to run roughshod with their devastation over the face of civilization. Once before we fell victims to their greed for power and lust for wealth, and awakened civilization, throbbing to the experience of the past 20 years, must not let history repeat itself. In passing from this point of discussion, and in face of a plenitude of evidence submitted by eminent Jews, that 65 to 75% of the officials of Soviet Russia are Jews who form only 2% of the population, what then is the purpose, or where is the substantiation, for Professor John W. Stanton's article, which is scheduled to appear in today's issue of the Detroit News, an article which says, quotations, to say that the Russian Revolution owes its origins to the activities of any group or foreign interests is to show only a superficial understanding of the facts underlying the forces that led to the downfall of the Romanovs and the advent of the Bolsheviks to power. Unquote. What is the purpose for making such an incorrect assertion in face of these government documents to which I have referred? Thanks be to God that the majority of Jews, poor humble persons like the majority of Christians, played no part in this. They, as were we, were the pawns upon the checkerboard of death and persecution. These I invite to stand with us in our battle against communism and Nazism. My friends, by inviting the religious Jews and religious Gentiles to join hands in assailing Nazism and communism, together with the injustices which produce the latter, I shall be castigated as one who stirreth up the multitude. Most probably I shall be scourged at the pillar in the hall of some modern Pontius Pilate. What of it? I shall continue my crusade with God's help for the humble Jew who has been the victim of persecution down the ages, and for the humble Christian whose wails have remained inarticulate, cost what it may. In my effort to arouse the decent elements of America to campaign against communism as well as Nazism, in my effort to appeal to the Jewish gentlemen who have risen to such prominence in the fields of radio, the press, and the cinema, the instruments which mold our public mind, I am characterized as being an anti-Semite. An anti-Semite because I decry atheistic Jews whom Jewry officially and consistently has not repudiated. May I reiterate what I emphasized last Sunday? There is no anti-Semitic question in America. There is an anti-communist question here. And there will continue to be an anti-communist question, veil it how you will, until we conquer, or until it conquers us. From it, there is no decent retreat on the part of decent Christians and decent Americans. Towards it, there is no respectable silence on the part of respectable, organized Jews. Thus, once more, I incorporate in the record of this day's speech a story told in the New York Times in reporting the meeting of the American Jewish Congress held in New York last October. Speaking of this group representing the Jews of the United States of America, the New York Times of October 31st, in its story of the opening session of the American Jewish Congress, said, quotation, "The mention of communism threw the convention into an uproar when delegates and visitors attempted to shout down Abraham Levine, a St. Louis, Missouri delegate, who demanded that a proposed declaration of the convention's principles be amended to include a denunciation of communistic theory. After heated discussion, Mr. Levine withdrew his demand," unquote. My friends, this silence towards communism, this refusal to condemn it officially on the part of this representative body of Jews, is beyond explanation. A reconvention of the American Jewish Congress is in order. A reconsideration of Mr. Levine's motion is also in order. Official Jewry must condemn officially not only the theory, but the practices of communism. Communism, whose policies have crimsoned the once blue river of Europe with the blood of 20 million martyrs, and which is making a charnel house of the cathedrals of Spain. To the highly intelligent Jews of America who recognize these truths, do I appeal? I humbly admit your influence, gentlemen, in banking, press, and radio. And I humbly suggest, for your own sake, and for the sakes of the less informed members of your race, that you, too, will recognize that there is no anti-Semitic question in America, but that there is an anti-communist question which must be solved. A question which cannot be solved except your genius and your assets are thrown into the battle on the side of God and country. In conclusion, I plead for impartiality in governmental decisions. And impartiality which will not only strike with all its might against the injustices of Nazism in regard to the Jews, but with equal strength will utilize its majesty in behalf of the persecuted Christians abroad, victims of communism. Before me, my friends, I have an original document which Mr. Roosevelt caused to be sent to a group of refugee Ukrainians resident in our nation. Ukrainians whose homes were confiscated, whose lands and businesses and chattels were seized, and whose relatives lie rotting in the soil, either of Hungary or of the Ukraine. These men and women and little children were the victims of Bella Kuhn, whose correct name is Aaron Cohen. The atheist Jew whose communist followers woke their crimson page of disaster a few years ago, from 1922 till, quotations, this enlightened day, unquote, so referred to by our president. This original official document, which Mr. Roosevelt, the President of the United States, caused to be sent to the chairman of these petitioners, reads as follows. Sir, the receipt is acknowledged by reference from the White House of your telegram of December 14, 1934. Addressed to the President, urging that he intercede with the Soviet government on behalf of Ukrainians in Soviet Ukraine who are being executed without trial during the new reign of terror instituted by the Moscow government. In reply, you are informed that this government is not in a position to make representations to foreign governments with respect to conditions which do not directly affect American citizens or interests. Very truly yours, for the Secretary of State, Robert F. Kelly, Chief. God forgive us. No intervention for Ukrainians and Hungarians, victims of Aaron Cohen, whose bodies now fertilize the golden wheat fields of Mid-Europe. But a plenitude of intervention and publicity for the Jews, not one of whom has been officially murdered. May the Holy Trinity infuse into the minds of our rulers a spirit of justice, of fairness, both to Christian and Jew, and if necessary, a spirit of militancy against the communists, both at home and abroad, whom up to this present moment, this government has been protecting, aiding, and abetting both by its silence, its cooperation, and its criminal good neighborliness. Good afternoon, my friends.
Gentlemen, you have listened to one of the most outstanding addresses delivered from the microphone of the Shrine of the Little Flower. Next week, Father Coughlin will be heard over these same stations, provided you are willing to support him in the presentation of these programs, which are paid for at full commercial rates. This is your program, not his. This is America's program. America comprised of Jew and Gentile, Christian and non-Christian. Please advertise this presentation, which we hope to make the most worthwhile hour on the air. And please write a letter to Father Coughlin this week to give him moral courage to carry on and to request a copy of this discourse to which you have just listened. We ask those who have written in last week for copies to be patient, if as yet they have not received their copy. Our mail is tremendous. Our staff is working overtime. This week at the latest, your copy will be in your hands. Sunday afternoon, this is your announcer, Franklin Mitchell, again bidding you on behalf of Father Coughlin, good afternoon.
ladies and gentlemen, we have presented the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles A. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan. The thoughts and opinions contained in this address were entirely those of the speaker and in no way reflect the policies of this station. We invite you to write your comments to WHBI, Newark, New Jersey.
Your dial is set at 1250 kilocycles. WHBI, Hoyt Brothers Incorporated, Newark, New Jersey.